You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, we'll look at the evolution of Europe's policies towards refugees. This week, German authorities in some states have begun confiscating valuables and cash from refugees entering the country to help fund their stay. It's following similar practices in Denmark and Switzerland. But have European governments gone too far? We'll have that debate. All that, plus a diplomatic spat involving Israel. We'll look at Hassan Rouhani's trip to Europe, Britain's place in Europe, and Nicolas Sarkozy's new book. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Nina Schick and Iva Gaber. Nina is Communications Director at the Open Europe think tank, and Iva is Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex. And both, of course, are regular Monocle 24 voices and contributors. Welcome both to the show. We're going to begin with a news story that's dominated headlines for months, Europe's refugee crisis. We've recently seen that some European governments have begun to seize valuables from refugees entering their country to help them pay for their stay. Denmark has done it, so has Switzerland, and now some German states are doing it too. It's a little bit unsavoury, and not everyone's quite sure what to make of it. Nina, so first of all, before we get too caught up in the luridness of it, so what the states such as Germany today, like Westphalia, are saying, we're going to take some money off migrants who have money because we don't think it's fair that people who have been living in Germany for many years are not allowed to have benefits until their wealth has reduced to a certain level, and we want to apply the same rules to refugees. So seemingly you can begin to understand it. But first of all, the levels of what people are allowed to keep seem terribly low, hundreds of euros. And there is, for Germany, surely just, you know, a terrible echo of Jewish refugees, of taking valuables of people. It seems like, you know, after opening the doors to these people, it seems like a terrible PR idea.
Absolutely. And I think this shows more than anything how much of a crisis Germany is in right now because of the refugee and migration crisis. I mean, they had 1.1 million people coming into the country over the past year, and politicians simply do not have to control this anymore. So in hindsight, perhaps it was a mistake by Chancellor Merkel to say that anybody could come to Germany and they would be offered protection. These proposals are not taking traction over all over Germany, and it's not certainly not.
Karen.
It's certainly not a solution on the national level. But where we see these proposals gathering traction is in those states which have been more. So Bavaria, for example, Westphalia, where they've had more refugees and migrants come in, and where public opinion has been turning quite vehemently against the Chancellor and her refugee policy because people think that she has absolutely no control over this anymore. So I think what we see here is that if there is no moderate debate in the middle ground and the government can't offer some kind of sensible or middle ground solution to help integrate the vast number of people coming in, then it becomes extreme. And that's what we're seeing all across Europe right now.
Iva, you know, what is the ambition of these charges? Is it really an attempt to create a level playing field, as the Germans are claiming? Or is it really just a simple intention to scare people down the line and to stop them coming?
No, I'm not sure it's the latter. I think we're in a post-Cologne situation. I think the public mood has changed as a result of the events that happened in Cologne at New Year, when a lot of German women were attacked. And I think there's a difference in mood, and this is a palpable attempt to implement a symbolic policy. And whilst, as Nina was saying, one understands why, it ain't good, particularly because of the low levels, and particularly because you think of how much these poor people have paid to the smugglers to get there. They've paid thousands of euros. They hang on to 1,000 euros or whatever to survive, and it's taken from them, or whatever the level is. So I do think one can understand why it's happened, but one grieves at what the effect is. But the other interesting thing, just en passant, there's been a lot of attention a few days ago to the Danes passing an act to now Germany, certain Bavarian German states implementing it. I did not know, and perhaps this is my ignorance, that the Swiss have been doing it for yonks. And as always, no, I mustn't say that. The Swiss have been doing it for yonks and getting away with it.
So what's interesting is, you know, I think that there seems to be a little bit of change. In fact, the Danes are allowing people to keep the most amount of money. It's still literally €1,000 per person. They're saying they're not going to take off people's wedding rings and, you know, really highly emotional items. But even in, as you begin to get in on that discussion, you think, okay, where is the logic in this? So you're saying to people, okay, you've pitched up in our country, we're not that keen on having you because you're not going to contribute to society. But what hope do people need to have of contributing if that, you know, potentially the €1,000 they could have used to start a business to pay for some English lessons or some Danish lessons or some German lessons is taken off them? It's kind of tying one hand behind all of these migrants' backs. You know, the fault is not at the end of this journey. The fault was at the beginning of the journey when the Germans said come without thinking about it. But now these people are here. It just seems very peculiar process to take these things off people.
Well, that is indeed one of the biggest challenges. I mean, the refugees and migrants, asylum seekers arriving is only the very first part of this equation. The second part, more importantly, is how do you integrate them into society? And if you're waiting as an asylum seeker to have your application looked at, I mean, because the social systems all over Europe and especially in Germany have been so overwhelmed by the sheer numbers, you're talking about up to a 3-year period before they even determine the application of your status. In that time, there are all kinds of restrictions on asylum seekers. They're not allowed to work. There are proposals floating around that, you know, they have to register their residence in one place and they can't move around. So this is, you know, a huge problem for societies like Germany as a whole, where people recognize that there's a massive demographic problem and they need young people to come into the country if Germany is to survive long term economically.
I kind of agree with you. The only thing I'd like to dive in there is I think this is where the conversation gets lost, because I think actually what's happening is, and you know, you see it in some gruesome ways, but in fact it's a more nuanced debate. I think there is also a different conversation, which is a cultural conversation, which is people, this is the post-cologne thing. This is people saying, okay, we understand that actually our community may not be as wealthy, you know, our economy may not do as well without these migrants. But you know what, I think that there's the issue now is many people are saying, do you know what, we can cope with that, but what we can't cope with is not migrants coming, but the pace of change. And that's the bit that's a bit more nuanced. You see, in the end, I don't know that economics wins the day.
Well, no, absolutely. And this is exactly where the debate is in Germany right now. And I think, you know, Cologne really served to focus that in people's minds, because Germany as a country, as a whole, has only recently, you know, come to see itself as a society that has a lot of migration, is not only traditionally German, but the pace of change has been too great. And this is why I think Merkel's statement this summer was, you know, a mistake, because now what happens is that public opinion in society turns against it for reasons which are true. They don't have the infrastructure to deal with the influx of people. And then that turns society against migrants. And there are real problems there, problems of integration, language problems. How do they work? Where do they work? They can't work for years. So they're just kept in these asylum camps for 3-4 years and they can't do anything. A lot of them are young men.
We had this kind of agreement in the summer, which was like, which was about, you know, getting migrants out of Germany, you know, sharing the burden, getting them to different places. You know, that was a kind of nice piece of agreement on paper. That I don't think any of that's happening. I bet if you're sitting, you know, in the Basque country in Bilbao, where I happened to be some months ago, and they would say, oh, I'm sure there'll be people coming here, I bet nobody has come. Because first of all, the migrants are migrants. They know how, they've moved across all of Europe to get here. They're not going to sit in a town where there's nothing for them to do and where they're bored. They're going to go somewhere where they can get a job, where they can restart their lives.
Yeah, although thinking about getting a job, I've got an interesting take on this, that in the summer when this was at the height and Merkel declared open door, we slightly sceptical journalists were saying, oh yes, but that's because they want the skills that these Syrians and others are bringing, because they're all the middle class, they're the ones with get up and go, they're the cream of the crop, And Germany has had problems of shortage of skilled labour. However, it now appears that only, I'm trying to recall the figure, I think it was 20%, if that had any usable skills, that the vast majority of people arriving can't contribute to the German economy in the way suggested. And my one little thought is that maybe we or they, because I wasn't involved in decision making, were a bit taken in by the fact that the only people we saw on television or heard on the radio were the articulate ones coming forward, the ones who spoke English. And therefore, they were grabbed by the interviewers, or maybe the ones who spoke German. And we formed the impression that here was this mass of skilled, highly articulate, highly educated people coming over and we'll take a few. And actually, the reality is not like that.
I think there is a fair point on the media filter that was put on this. And I think the other, you know, we were, Monocle was in Europe this summer doing some events, and we travelled on a train from Vienna to Munich. And what was interesting was, you know, that there were, you know, families travelling with their children, and there were some unaccompanied children as well on the train that we were on. But what was most fascinating was that when that train pulled into the station, I would say 60-70% of the people were single males, traveling, you know, in groups with friends, but mainly, I'd guess, anything from like 16 up to like 22, 23. Many were probably Syrians, but many seemed to be from their language and how they were talking, potentially Albanian, Afghani, Iraqi. So a much more mixed bag. And I think that's the problem, you know, It was just so fast and so unprocessed that all of these things that need to be on the ground are not happening. And then you get this kickback. You get this horrible kickback about, okay, now we're going to take your money from you.
Well, interestingly, the vice president of the commission came out yesterday and he said that according to preliminary data, they think that 60% of the people in this refugee flow are actually economic migrants. Yes, some of them come from countries, you know, where it's impoverished, the situation isn't great. I'm talking about Afghanistan, African countries, North African countries, but they think that 60% of them are economic migrants and not actually Syrian refugees fleeing from war. And basically, I don't know how accurate that statistic is, but basically it goes to show that there was simply no control. They had no idea who was coming into the borders. Everyone was coming in. And of course, there's going to be a backlash towards that. There was, you know, including, it started, of course, with Paris, when it turned out that some of the Paris attackers had entered via Greece because there's no fingerprinting, no controls at the border. And one of them, in fact, was known to the European authorities and he had a European arrest warrant out on his name and he was still able to enter the EU. So if the EU cannot protect its external borders and control the people who are coming in, it's no wonder that people turn then to nationalism, become, you know, want to shut down their borders. And we're seeing that right now.
Well, let's just broaden this debate a little bit, because we'll turn to Britain's place in Europe. Brexit has been an ever-present threat, of course, Britain's exit from the European Union. But will it actually happen? Yesterday, the chief economist at Deutsche Bank said that Britain's exit from the EU would have a devastating impact on Europe, turning the continent into what he called a second-rank world power. Now, this might be a slight hyperbole here, but what is interesting is it does seem that at the heart of Europe there is growing concern, Ivor, that, you know, the narrative is running away from them. Even a year ago, when you looked at the polls, the polls, it was clear that Britain would stay in the end. There was a sizable number of people here in the UK were angered, disappointed, dismayed with what the European Union was doing. But when it came to the end, when it came to putting their cross on the ballot paper, they would vote stay. Now everyone's not so sure, and partly because of this very migration story we're talking about. What do you think, our departure, the British departure from Europe, would really kind of pull down the whole project?
Let me just backtrack on something you said, which I think is very interesting, because I think one of the problems we now have in this country is, as you say, a year, maybe 2 years ago, it was pretty solidly pro. But what's happened, not just in Britain, but around the world, is this revolt against the establishment, whether it's Trump in the United States, the election of a very left-wing leader of the Labour Party, the Scottish Nationalist rise. People are voting against the established order. And that, for me, as somebody who's very keen on British membership of Europe, is the worry that people won't really listen to the debate. They'll just think, oh, it's those establishment politicians again. I'm not voting for them. I like their UKIP. I like the cut of their jib, to use an awful expression. So that's the background. And that's why I think it's very difficult. But just to answer your question from a European perspective, I think the other 27 are between the proverbial rock and a hard place, because on the one hand, as the German foreign, as the governor of the German, forgotten who he mentioned.
He's the chief economist right, at Deutsche Bank.
Okay, because I was listening to something from the German foreign ministry as well. They don't want Britain to leave. They're realising, or maybe they've always realised, how much Britain contributes, not so much in terms of economics, but in terms of balancing the Franco-German alliance, giving the European Union another place on the UN Security Council, etc., etc. They realise that. They're desperate to keep Britain in, but, and it's a big but, they don't want to make it that they're leaning over backwards to keep Britain in, because they fear that if they do that and give too many concessions, there's a queue behind Britain of other countries who perhaps don't want to leave, but they want better terms for this, that or the other. So they can't roll over and say to David Cameron, what do you want? On the other hand, they're desperate to give him something.
There's a foreign policy question here, Nina, which is interesting. If you're facing down an ever more antagonistic Russia, if you're concerned about on the economic stage as well, if you're concerned about how you'll face up to the US and its success and China's potential success if it rebounds in the coming years, you know, the EU is a mighty thing together, and suddenly you realise that, you know, we felt it was just a kind of a UK debate, and in Europe no one really cared if we came or left. It turns out they rather want us at the party.
Oh, absolutely, because, I mean, if you look at the EU globally, it is declining in terms of power, economic power as well. A few decades ago, it accounted for, EU's GDP accounted for 30% of global GDP. Now that figure is at 15%. When we're talking about the UK, you're talking about the second largest contributor to the EU budget, the world's sixth largest economy, the one of the two defence powers in the EU, Britain and France, and you're talking about a country that's actually played a tremendous role in advancing the single market. You know, it was the UK that wanted to liberalise the single market. It was the UK that initially was pushing for the expansion of the EU eastward. So when you consider all of this, it's hardly surprising that the rest of the EU countries are terribly afraid of a Brexit, because this would be the third crisis on a series of crises when the EU is already facing an existential crisis. We have the Eurozone crisis still going on, the migration crisis still going on, no end in sight. And then you have the second largest economic power of the EU leaving a club where people have only wanted to join. That shakes it to its very foundation.
The conversation happening here in the UK, it does seem to be echoed actually in many other countries in ways that we didn't even see again a few years ago. I think that you touched on a very interesting point about, you know, Donald Trump and the, you know, the
Syriza Corbyn. As well,
yeah, oh yeah, this kind of loss of faith in some of the old institutions and the ways of doing politics. I wonder in all of these countries whether some of it, of course, you know, on the right and left heads off into the fringes. But actually at the centre of that debate, again, is there something that's interesting, which is just a feeling that, you know, in the end, we've touched on it already, that actually we understand we want to be part of Europe. That's a nice thing. We want to trade. We want to do cultural things. We want to be, you know, we want to feel kind of European and have our holiday home in Spain. But at the end, whether we go back home to Helsinki or Hull, we want to feel that when we get home, there's a bit of, there's a separate culture there, that we're not all being ironed flat. And that's the problem with some of the European project. It does seem to be desperate to make everything the same everywhere.
Well, yes, and I think we can have our Euro cake and eat it. I do believe that, if, for example, if you go to Germany, there's a sense of being within within the European space, but it feels very different from being in France or Italy or Spain. I think, and those are countries I know reasonably well, they have retained their separate identity whilst giving you a sense of being much more European than the UK. We in Britain have failed to make that merger. Maybe it's because, as was said some time ago, we've lost an empire, not found a role. Maybe it's because of our close ties to the United States. But other European countries, I don't think, suffer this homogenisation that you're talking about.
Nina?
I actually agree with you, Andrew, because I think that that is, you know, the tremendous failing of the European project. And, you know, when it was found, the founding fathers, they envisaged a Europe that would be ever closer, unite more, United States of Europe, a federal vision of Europe. And what the past few years have shown is that not just in the UK, but all over Europe, people don't want that. They don't want one size fits all model. They want to have their own homogenous identity. And the more you try to force them to integrate more and become this pan-European dream, the more they kick back. And you see this across all the EU nations, including in Germany, where you have an anti-Euro and anti-establishment party, now basically the third largest party.
And I was going to dive in, because I think the other fascinating thing is, you know, you forget that, you know, when this project started in, you know, post-war, but even when the 70s were happening, when Britain joined, it was only 30 years since the Second World War. So nations had this feeling, hold on, we would rather make a few alliances, drop a few barriers, be friends with people, because we know the consequences of what can happen if we don't.
This is the longest period of Europe without war since the Charlemagne.
But the trouble is, you
earlier.
Have a generation now who have no, you know, even in the 70s, if you were living in London, and you walk down the street, you could still see the bomb sites. You know, the city hadn't changed, the country hadn't changed. But now that sense of, you know, we have to do a little bit of give and take to keep everyone happy, it's kind of a little bit lost, do you think, Nina?
I think the only way that the EU can get through this is if they find it within themselves to have a more flexible model of integration. So if certain countries such as Germany and France wish to integrate more, you know, nobody should hold them back from doing that. But on the outside, you have countries like the UK and perhaps even in the future, Switzerland, perhaps Turkey, who don't quite fit into that European mold and want to have their own identity, but they're still within the European sphere. And the way you do that is by creating a trading space where they're all linked economically, if not politically.
Well, I'm going to dive in because we're going to come back with Sarkozy, with Iran and Israel right after this.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Well, we got a bit feisty at the front of the show, so we're going to rattle, I think, through the next few stories. But here goes. Still with me is Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Nina Schick, who is Communications Director at the Open Europe think tank. Now, let's look at the visit of Hassan Rouhani, Iran's president, to Europe. After 3 days in Italy, Rouhani arrived in France today for the next phase of his state visit here in Europe. His mission? Securing lucrative trade deals after international sanctions have been lifted. Is it time now for Iran to be welcomed back into the party, Ivor?
Well, I think they've already been welcomed back by most countries bar Israel. You know, once Washington took the decision to implement the lifting of sanctions, I understand that the lifting of sanctions is quite a slow process. But I have to say, Iran must be cursing their luck to go no further, that the sanctions get lifted at the moment when the world price of oil is just about rock bottom. And it's serious economic problems for them, that we know they've been in an economic depression, and it ain't going to get better anytime soon, not just because of the world oil price, but because the rest of the world economy is not going to be in the state that they were hoping it would be when they were looking forward to this nirvana.
Nina, both in Paris and in Italy, he's had an amazing welcome. And as we said, maybe back in Jerusalem or Riyadh, there are a few people spitting. But it's amazing, the turnaround in fortunes. And it's interesting, I guess it's a temptation for other countries. It's saying, look, you come along with us, you agree to what the UN wants, you agree to what other countries feel is best for you, look what you get from it. because really, you know, they have done everything to make him feel incredibly welcome. We've seen this ridiculous story about supposedly some naked statues in Italy being covered up. Everyone's denying they had anything to do with it. But, you know, they've certainly gone out of their way to do everything to make him feel like an honoured guest.
I mean, it's certainly captured the public imagination. And, you know, all of France has been talking about this for about a week, which is quite interesting when you have... you know, this. Who is this guy in his robe and his turban? What does he represent? And that isn't surprising because France actually used to have very close relations with Iran before the revolution. And, you know, they were one of the biggest investors there. So they will be hoping as well to... Peugeot was one of the biggest car manufacturer back in the day in Iran. So they'll be hoping to use this as a way back in. And I think that people... in Europe and in France in particular, when you look at the history that France and Iran have, despite it being quite marred in the past few years, you know, France was very tough on the nuclear brief, arguably more than the US, that there's just a bit of a fascination with this country, which has been so isolated.
We're going to have to dive on because we want to touch on this story now in Israel, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has come out strongly against international criticism of Israeli settlements. Yesterday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called the settlements provocative acts, with Netanyahu responding that Ban's remarks give a tailwind to terrorism. Ivor, is this fair?
Sigh. There's, you know, the Pope is Catholic, big news. I mean, Netanyahu attacking the UN is something that has become a modus vivendi for many, many years. Is what Ban says fair? I mean, if you're asking my personal opinion, I say yes. Did he express it well at a time when Israelis are being stabbed in the street, when he talked about understanding how people react to... occupation. We know what he means, but I'm not sure now was the right time because what's happening in Israel now, it's very vivid, let's put it like that. So there is a greater sensitivity to criticism of that. But I think a general criticism about the illegal settlements, which let's face it, even Washington has been outspoken on, was quite appropriate.
You know, there has been a change. We see it in DC. We see it in other capitals. People are not prepared now just to keep their mouths shut. They're letting it be known that they do not like the way that this policy is developing. And of all the justifications and all the explanations, it just doesn't quite wash. But does nothing against public opinion in Israel, and does nothing, it seems, to ever affect what the political elite do.
I mean... I guess what can the political elite do? Even if they did some kind of resolution at the UN, you know, would that carry?
No,
much
I mean the Israeli political elite. You have no feeling that this is changing mood or mindset there.
Well, perhaps it's, you know, a feeling of fortress even more so if people are attacking them from all sides, including their traditional ally, the US. I mean, the UK, the EU, and Israel has had tetchy relationships for a while, but that shift in Israeli-US relations must be hurting them.
And it's not really the political elite across the board. It's the right wing politically. Netanyahu was in really close to losing power until he pulled out the sort of racist trick of saying, quick, get down and vote because the Arabs are turning out. There is a centre-left movement in Israel which is getting stronger. And I predict, he says foolishly, they might win the next election.
Well, you heard it here first. We'll see. I'm not 100% convinced, but we move on to our final story, which is that the former French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, has a new book out titled La France pour la vie, or France for Life, and it's been deemed a bestseller already. It only came out on Monday. Some are saying this is first salvo in getting back into office proper. So it's a kind of mea culpa. He's like said, look, I did some really stupid things. It wasn't wise to go on an oligarch's yacht and sunbathe after I'd just been in power a few days. I shouldn't have been rude to people. Do you think these books help, Ivor?
I'm just thinking, if Sarkozy has written a book about all the mistakes he made in office, it's probably one of the biggest books in the history of autobiographies. Will it help? I don't think so. I think Sarkozy is a busted flush. I think the polls now are suggesting that it's going to be Marine Le Pen against Hollande if he's a socialist party. I think Sarkozy also, I'm not sure that, I'm trying to remember the name of his new party, they renamed themselves. I'm not even sure they'll nominate him for president.
Nina, he's a bit like Blair in way, you know, a man of the time in many ways, you know, perhaps more popular overseas in the end than at home in the UK. But what's interesting is, you know, the game has changed, whether it's, you know, because of terrorism, it's because of, you know, migration. It just seems a little bit out of whack. And I'm going to allow you 30 seconds to give your detailed response to this.
Absolutely. I mean, I doubt that Sarkozy will even win the election. It'll probably be the nomination to become the presidential candidate. It'll probably be Alain Juppé. And from the last time he was in office, you know, they have a lot to contend with economically and politically with the rise of Front National.
Well, a really interesting show, but we're going to have to leave it there. You've heard from Nina Schick, who's Communications Director at the Open Europe think tank, and also from Ivor Gaber, who's a Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex. Thanks to both of them for joining me today on Midori House. And as I said, that's all we have time for. The show, well, it was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Eugenie Derez. And Toby Hammond was our studio manager. For the next half hour, there's going to be plenty of music from Monaco International playlist, some good tunes to get your toes tapping, and the 1900 hours, there's even more shows coming your way with the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. But this show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is of course 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.